And now, the BBC World Service on CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph.
Military intervention in Libya as rebels say they're completely outgunned.
They used 7 tanks, 3 of which went all the way to the town center, supported by about 25 vehicle-mounted heavy artillery. They were shooting indiscriminately.
Accusations of corruption aren't enough to stop Jacques Chirac being France's most popular political figure, and he's just been put on trial.
Several lawyers had several years of investigations on that topic, and it's the minimum we should do, see him in court.
How can financial brokers trade in something they never even planned to own? European politicians take on the naked short sellers. That's coming on the World Service after the news.
BBC News with Neil Nunes. President Barack Obama has said the United States and its NATO allies are still considering a military response to the situation in Libya, where he said the people were facing unacceptable violence. The British Foreign Secretary, William Hague, told Parliament that they were working closely with partners on the UN Security Council on a no-fly zone resolution.
We are making contingency plans for all eventualities in Libya. NATO has been tasked to work on a range of options, including the possible establishment of a no-fly zone, the evacuation of civilians, international humanitarian assistance, and support to the international arms embargo. At the UN Security Council, we are working closely with partners on a contingency basis on elements of a resolution on a no-fly zone, making clear the need for regional support and an appropriate legal basis.
Reports from Libya say opposition-held territory has again come under sustained attack from land and air. A series of airstrikes targeted the oil town of Ras Lanuf, where opposition fighters regrouped after being pushed back from the key coastal town of Bin Jawad on their march westward to the capital Tripoli. Several fatalities were reported after the air attack. Colonel Gaddafi's troops were also reported to have resumed their attacks on the city of Zawiya. The newly appointed interim government in Tunisia has dissolved the secret police. The notorious state security apparatus was blamed for many human rights abuses. Magdi Abdelhadi has this report.
Dismantling the state security police has been a key demand of the opposition that toppled the former president Zain al-Abidine Ben Ali in January. It's an organization that has been blamed for much of the human rights abuses in the past. Scrapping this much-hated agency will be seen as the ultimate victory over the regime of Mr. Ben Ali, where the secret police played a key role in suppressing the opposition. The decision to dissolve the secret police was announced shortly after a new transitional government that has no ministers from the former regime was announced. With this, the Tunisian revolution appears to have met two of its main goals.
The United States says it's considering sending military liaison officers to Uganda to help track down the rebel Lord's Resistance Army, which has spread a campaign of terror across a huge area of Central Africa. Currently, information from aerial surveillance arrives in Uganda too late to be used on the ground as it passes through the U.S. military. A senior U.S. official, Johnny Carson, said that American liaison officers could be attached to the Ugandan military to help speed up the process.
That is an option that is on the table and is being considered. And if it makes sense as a element to be able to eliminate Kony, we will actively pursue it.
BBC World News.
CFRU is looking for new shows. We want you to make media here. We are especially looking for arts, news, and political content. We want to make media that is current, edgy, and unlike anything else heard in Guelph. We want to make media that is social justice savvy, community-minded, and represents the richness of our communities. We want to make media that is inclusive of First Nations people, queer and trans folk, communities of color, seniors, folks of all abilities, women, girls, and youth. No previous experience necessary and training is provided. Get involved as a tech, host, producer, researcher, or one of 1,000 other things. Yes, you. Contact programming at cfru.ca.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to Terra Informa, your source for environmental news. This week, we bring you a special originally aired in June 2010 on the Northern Gateway Pipeline. Considering the recent disputes between BC Natives groups and Enbridge, we thought it appropriate to re-air this special. But first, here's Jason with the news.
A recent study commissioned by Health Canada shows that Native communities who supplement their diet with traditional food sources, such as salmon, moose, and berries, are measurably healthier than those that do not. We know people are eating a combination of market foods and traditional foods, but we didn't know the ratio. What we do know is that the traditional food is much healthier than the market food, said Donald Sharp, lead investigator for the study. Obesity, heart disease, and diabetes are epidemic among First Nations people, diseases that were unheard of 100 years ago. Although BC has the lowest rate of obesity in Canada, at just under 11%, the obesity rate for First Nations people overall is around 32%. Obesity is a contributing factor to both heart disease and diabetes. The report will be a starting point for advocacy work by the Assembly of First Nations to ensure that First Nations communities have access to nutritious food and to remove regulatory impediments to hunting, fishing, and foraging in traditional territories. Now to the Yukon, where environment officials say they may ease caribou hunting restrictions along the Dempster Highway. As the latest porcupine caribou survey show, the herd has grown by almost 50,000 animals in the last decade. According to figures from aerial photograph surveys, the herd has grown from about 123,000 individuals in 2001 to 169,000 individuals. It is good news for everybody, particularly when you consider that there had been caribou herds over the Northwest Territories that have declined very rapidly in size, said Dennis Senger, manager of communications with Yukon's Environment Department. We had that concern that it might happen with the porcupine caribou. With other caribou herds in decline across the north, wildlife managers in both Yukon and Alaska had feared the worst for the cross-border porcupine herd. The herd peaked in 1989 at 170,000 caribou. But four photo surveys between 1992 and 2001 documented a decline to 123,000 caribou, a drop of more than 30%. In the fall of 2009, the Yukon government imposed temporary hunting regulations along the Dempster Highway to protect the porcupine herd, which is considered to be the largest caribou herd in the territory. Under the temporary rules, licensed Yukon hunters could harvest only one caribou bull per season. There were also restrictions on what Aboriginal subsistence hunters could take from the herd. The numbers now put the caribou under the harvest management plan to what they call the green zone. That means that licensed Yukon hunters can take up to two bulls, and there would be no limit on subsistence harvest, Senger said. Yukon officials will meet later this month to consider proposed changes to the regulations. The numbers now put the caribou under the harvest management plan to what they call the green zone. That means that licensed Yukon hunters can take up to two bulls, and there would be no limit on subsistence harvest. Yukon officials will meet later this month to consider proposed changes to the regulations. In national news, the Harper government's latest spending plan forecasts cuts to climate change initiatives and cultural programs, but extra cash for law and order. Treasury Board President Stockwell Day announced the spending plan in an Ottawa-area gym called Lean and Fit, suggesting the new budget will work towards shrinking Canada's deficit by trimming the fat. This would be the first time in over 10 years that a government is planning spending that is less than the year before, Mr. Day said. The 2011-2012 budget forecast for all government departments will be $250.8 billion, a $10.4 billion reduction from estimates a year earlier, a year that showed record-high government spending as a result of the two-year temporary stimulus program. Compared to the 2008-2009 fiscal year, the spending plan announced on Tuesday is 13% higher than government spending prior to the recession. Infrastructure-related spending takes the biggest hit as the stimulus ends, but cuts are also forecast for environmental, cultural, and social programs. Meanwhile, government-wide spending on security and public safety programs is in line for a 10% boost, and justice and legal programs will receive a 4.8% increase. Environmentalists were particularly alarmed by estimates showing a 20% cut to Environment Canada, including a 59% reduction in spending for climate change and clean air, and a 51% cut to substance and waste management.
Thanks, Jason. Now here is Marcus to tell you about our investigation into the Northern Gateway Pipeline.
As millions of liters of oil wash up on the shores of the Gulf of Mexico, tough questions are being asked about the environmental costs of our thirst for petroleum. Calgary Energy Company Enbridge has plans to build an oil pipeline from refineries in Edmonton to a new supertanker port in Kitimat on British Columbia's coastline. Later in the show, we'll be examining the environmental and economic perspectives on this proposal. But firstly, we'll look at the potential impacts of the First Nations communities along the route. David Karchin filed this report.
That's the sound of links of industrial pipe being welded together. If Calgary Energy Company Enbridge gets its way, it's a sound that might be ringing out across the hills of Alberta and British Columbia in only a few years' time. To oil industry workers, companies and shareholders, that sound represents dollars in the bank. To environmentalists, it's the sound of a future oil spill in the making. To some First Nations communities, it's the sound of territorial infringement and risk to their way of life. Today on this special edition of Terra Informa, we investigate a proposal for one of Canada's biggest and most controversial infrastructure projects. Enbridge wants to build a pipeline from the refineries north of Edmonton to a specially constructed deepwater port, Kitimat, British Columbia. From there, the oil would be loaded onto supertankers, which would transit the Douglas Channel, a narrow stretch of water surrounded by the iconic Great Bear Rainforest, before heading out into the Pacific. The entire operation would move over 500,000 barrels of oil daily from the heart of Canada's oil patch to the lucrative markets in East Asia. Billions in benefits and hundreds of jobs, says Enbridge, and as Andy Reid investigates in the next section on today's program, the pipeline is likely to generate sizable revenues. But a growing number of opponents believe the benefits aren't worth the risks. Just 2 weeks ago, Enbridge submitted its project proposal for assessment by the BC and federal governments. The company already has BC Premier Gordon Campbell on their side.
Billions of dollars of investment, thousands of jobs for people across the north, particularly for First Nations, build the capacity for First Nations, which they've been asking us to build for a number of years now, and all of that will be done within an environmental framework that is secure for the long-term future of British Columbia.
However, not many British Columbians agree. A poll last month found 80% opposition to the heavy tanker shipping traffic that the project entails. More importantly, 28 BC First Nations have registered their opposition to the proposal, including every First Nation on the north and central coast. Last month, a super coalition of campaign groups took out a full-page advertisement in the Globe and Mail with a picture of the Exxon Valdez disaster and the words, "This was Exxon's gift to Alaska. BC can expect the same from Enbridge." One Aboriginal territory on the proposed route is the Nardewutan First Nation. Terra Informa spoke with Representative Tara Marson about her community's opposition.
First of all, there are significant impacts to be concerned about. Second of all, the number of jobs are low, and it's unlikely that they will go to local communities because of the skills requirements. And third of all, that the consultation process that the federal government has proposed is inadequate to deal with a project of this size, and it doesn't deal with Aboriginal rights and title effectively.
First Nations seem serious about this. A gathering of around 1,000 delegates met in Kitimat 2 weeks ago to voice their concern. Tara Marsden.
It's really a show of solidarity amongst the First Nations as well as non-First Nations organizations and individuals who want to stop this project.
And what are some of the common concerns that were being voiced?
Well, because it was in Kitimat, this one focused quite a bit on the tanker route. So the concerns were basically that all it is going to take is one spill, and that's definitely not something that the company can guarantee won't happen. One spill and these coastal communities will lose their entire way of life.
Inland First Nations also fear a spill. As Indigenous Rights Campaigner for Amnesty International, Craig Benjamin explains, for many Aboriginal communities, environmental and social impact is closely related.
All of these rivers and streams are vital to the First Nations for activities that are central both to their cultural identity and have an ongoing importance to their economy.
From the perspective of Amnesty International, and for that matter the United Nations, the project should only go ahead if there is free, prior and informed consent from all Aboriginal groups affected. Craig Benjamin.
And there has to be, at the end of the day, a willingness to say, if the affected people deem that in their best judgment, their rights need to be protected by saying no to a project, that will be respected.
The project assessment by the federal government will take 2 years. Given current opposition, however, it is difficult to imagine that in its current form, the proposal will win back First Nations support, regardless of the review.
Do you think a compromise is possible from where we are at the moment? There is very strong opposition to the project. Is there something Enbridge could do that could allay those concerns?
Our entry point is not the project per se. Our entry point is the fact that First Nations have at this point so clearly said that they don't want this project, or at least a large number of First Nations said they don't want this project. So I think really the test for this is up to those First Nations themselves. You know, they are the ones who are in the best position to determine how their rights need to be respected. And I think it's important to point out that some of these nations, like the Carrier-Sakani Nation, have engaged with Enbridge. They have engaged with the project. They've carried out studies. They've carried out consultation and discussions within their own communities. So when they come and say, we don't want this project, they're not saying so as any kind of knee-jerk reaction. They're saying so on the basis of a lot of careful consideration, a lot of review of the data. So it's hard to imagine that there could be new information at this point that would come forward that would change that view. But really, of course, that's up to the First Nations themselves.
Clearly, Enbridge has an uphill battle on its hands. From the perspective of First Nations, the project is a no-go. Environmentalists, too, are staunchly opposed, and the joint campaign from these groups will be difficult to overcome. The Globe and Mail described the impending argument to be bigger than Clackwit Sound. This might be an exaggeration, but it's still going to be fierce.
Thanks, Dave. Great work. You're listening to Terra Informa, and I'm your host, Marcus Peterson. Now we have the second installment of our ongoing series, Local Campaigns, where Terra Informa correspondent Miles Curry covered the No Tanks Vancouver organization.
This week on Local Campaigns, I speak to Jeff Harrison of the No Tanks campaign based out of Vancouver. No Tanks is a citizens group that wants to protect the fragile ecosystem of the West Coast and the communities that depend on it from destruction caused by oil supertankers. The campaign was developed out of the need to both oppose the increased oil tanker traffic on the West Coast, as well as respond to the widespread public misconceptions surrounding public policies pertaining to oil tanker traffic on the West Coast. Jeff was kind enough to fill me in on the background of these misconceptions and how they affect his group's campaign.
British Columbians generally under the impression that we have a tanker moratorium set up or supposedly set up by the Trudeau government years ago after the Exxon Valdez spill. Unfortunately, this is not actually a legally binding moratorium, nor does this moratorium apply to the North or South Coast tanker traffic that we are experiencing now. And so since we're all under this impression that tankers are banned, the public is completely unaware that the tanker traffic in Vancouver has been quite rapidly ramped up since 2001. For example, in 2000, we were only exporting 8,000 tons of crude oil a year. And then last year in 2009, we were almost at 4 million tons.
With greater tanker traffic comes a greater risk of an accident. I asked Jeff to describe to me what is put at risk in BC due to this increase in oil tanker traffic.
So in Vancouver, we depend heavily on our coast for, marine traffic, tourism, fishing, shellfish harvesting, pleasure boating, and our oceanfront businesses like restaurants and clubs, and our whole reputation is at stake with this spill. In terms of social risk, we may lose some of our beaches or it'll be fouled. Our public health could be affected, as would the reallocation of public resources. And obviously, in terms of ecological risk, we risk our marine ecosystems, our mammals, our birds, and our intertidal zones. Our goal is pretty straightforward. We are going to stop the tankers that are currently leaving Vancouver.
Well, the No Tanks campaign may seem to be inherently a local BC campaign, the organizers have a very acute sense of how this campaign plays into national policy and national politics on environmental issues.
It's difficult for the entire country to value the coast as we do, because the coast here is a part of our livelihood, part of our identity, and so we value it so much more than its economic output. In the national interest, we shouldn't be exporting crude oil out of the continent in a time when oil resources are dwindling. Eastern Canada right now is importing a lot of their oil, and yet in Western Canada here, we're looking at exporting more of it. In No Tanks, we would like to see the export of oil from Western to Eastern Canada so that we don't need to risk our coast.
For more information on the No Tanks campaign, including research and ways to donate, head to www.notanks.org.
Thanks, Miles. Andy Reid is now going to take a critical look at the economics and politics of Canada's petroleum market and where the Northern Gateway pipeline fits in.
As most people familiar with economics and markets know, there are two major factors in receiving the maximum value for a product, those being the supply of what you are selling and the demand for what you are selling. If you're selling natural resources, there is typically a static supply, limited by the resource extraction facilities that are available to you. Therefore, to maximize value for your resource products, you must ensure that you have a maximum supply penetration to allow you to sell your products to as many different customers as possible. However, Alberta's situation has never been as simple as this. In the past, Alberta's close proximity to the massive U.S. market for oil has allowed us to think single-mindedly and simply look to our southern neighbors to buy our products. This is illustrated best by investigating a map of North American pipelines and noticing that Alberta's oil export pipelines don't even make it as far as Manitoba, leaving our eastern Canadian friends having to repurchase our Canadian oil from the markets of the United States. This situation has led to Alberta exporting around 70% of our oil production to the United States and becoming the largest supplier of crude to the United States simply due to our one-customer market. In the past, with seemingly unending American demand for petroleum, this has not been a problem. American markets were paying top dollar for oil, and we continued to cash our checks. However, this is no longer the case. With other world powers building their economies, new markets are arising that have never existed before. In particular, nations considered to be developing economies have been increasingly demanding natural resources. This was reflected in the actions of the Western provinces on May 17th of 2010, when the conglomerate of BC, Alberta, and Saskatchewan's provincial governments organized the New West Partnership Trade Office in China to oversee the growing demand for our products in that country.
This is an historic day for the three provinces. It's historic for the province of Saskatchewan, to be sure, as today represents our first representation, our first presence in China. The relationship between Western Canada and China can answer many of those questions.
And this issue isn't even a point of contention between political parties, with Liberal leader Michael Ignatieff admitting the importance of the Chinese and Indian markets to Canadian prosperity.
You get it, but the rest of Canada doesn't get it. Doesn't get that our economic future is tied to China and India, the subcontinent in general. We have to do a tremendously better job than we're doing about export promotion to China and export promotion to the markets of India. One of the things we've failed to do is to use the populations of our own country, our native citizens, our fellow neighbors and brothers and sisters who speak the languages of these regions, the languages of South Asia, the languages of China, but the family connection, the entrepreneurial connections. We've never used our native-born Canadians of these Asian ancestries to build the bridge to those markets. The bottom line message, which I come back to, is the crisis should teach Canada we can't afford to put our economic eggs in one basket, namely the United States. We've got to develop these other markets. Our future is across the Pacific Ocean.
So given this change of focus in the oil markets, we can expect there to be increased efforts in getting our production out to the West Coast by any means. Enter the Northern Gateway Pipeline Project. This project, being pursued by Enbridge Pipelines, is planned to ultimately transport 500,000 barrels a day of oil directly to the new marine terminal in Kitimat, BC, and import almost 200,000 barrels a day of condensate, an additive required for bitumen transportation. This currently small port is being designed to house a number of large oil tanks for storage of the oil before loading into tanker ships before the long voyage across the Pacific. But wait a minute. Any of our listeners from Burnaby, BC will remember this sound.
Well, I just talked to the guys. It's supposed to be 3 meters from the center of the road, and it wasn't.
This is the sound of oil flowing out of the Kinder Morgan pipeline running underground down the Barnett Highway in Burnaby, BC, which was revealed in July of 2007 when a backhoe accidentally punctured the line. Kinder Morgan's Trans Mountain pipeline already delivers oil from Edmonton, Alberta to Burnaby, BC, and they have stated that incremental expansion of this line would satisfy the additional transportation capacity which the Northern Gateway Pipeline is planned to service. This led to a response to the filing of the Northern Gateway Pipeline project with the government from Kinder Morgan Canada President Ian Anderson, in which he stated, quote, "We believe that the continued expansion of our existing pipeline along existing right-of-way will have less environmental and traditional First Nations territory impacts, along with lower business risks and costs." Kinder Morgan says that the additional expansions of their route could add another 400,000 barrels a day capacity to the line, almost matching the capacity of the Gateway project, and they are requesting that the National Energy Board defer further consideration of the project until Enbridge can demonstrate that adequate commercial support for the project exists. We must remember that there are always alternatives available to us. The question then becomes one of subjectivity. Do we need an entire new line running through undisturbed natural lands to further development of new ports, or shall we expand our current infrastructure and minimize the impact to our natural environment? Understanding that economics and markets are driving the decision to move our oil westward, which route would you take?
Thanks, Andy. Amid the fight against climate change and the ongoing outrage over oil spills, environmental concerns abound in the debate over the proposed Northern Gateway Pipeline. Robin Curry, Brett Taggart, and I put together an in-depth look at the possible environmental impacts of the project. So far on today's show, we've looked at the indigenous and economic perspectives of the Northern Gateway Pipeline, but what are the potential environmental impacts and risks? We can consider the environmental effects on two parts: those from the pipeline itself, and those from the expansion in oil sands productions that the pipeline facilitates. Let's start with the impacts of the increased oil sands production. A pipeline able to carry 500,000 barrels of oil daily would allow for 28% increase in total oil production, according to a report by the Pembina Institute. Today we bring you a summary of the environmental costs of such an increase, focusing on water use, land use, air pollution, and tailings ponds as calculated by the Pembina Institute. Let's talk about water first. The amount of water used to produce one barrel of bitumen differs depending on the type of production used. In the case of an oil sands mine, where the ore is mined and transported to where it is processed into usable oil, up to 4 barrels of water is needed to produce 1 barrel of usable petroleum. With in-situ development, where the oil is extracted using steam wells instead of mining, water use can be considerably less, with less than 1 barrel of water used. Given the expansion that the pipeline allows for, it's estimated that an additional 200 million barrels of water could be used in processing each year, the same amount that would be used to supply water to a city with 250,000 population. However, in the case of a city, most of the water is returned to the watershed after being processed at a water treatment plant, and afterwards it is then reused. In the case of oil production, most if not all of the fresh water that is used then goes into the oil product, into a tailings pond, or becomes steam that is needed to be treated to remove contaminants. Once a freshwater source has been exhausted, it can take decades to be replenished through rain or groundwater. On the issue of tailings, the increase in production would create an estimated 700,000 additional barrels of liquid waste daily, enough to fill 4.5 Olympic-sized swimming pools. Within a year, the tailings could fill 1.5 BC play stadiums, and seepage from the tailings ponds into the groundwater and surface water systems would amount to 7,300 barrels a day. The water in the tailings solution cannot be reprocessed and returned to the water system because of the suspended contaminants. 74 billion cubic feet of natural gas would be used in additional processing each year. This is roughly the same amount that would be used in heating 1.3 million homes in Canada, and just over one-third of British Columbia's total gas use for homes, businesses, and industry. Those are some of the estimated impacts of an increase in oil sands extraction, based on the Pembina Institute's calculations based on current operations. But the pipeline itself has many environmentalists worried also. The pipeline will intersect nearly 1,000 different streams and rivers, such as the Upper Fraser, Skeena, and Kitimat rivers, some of which are vital to fish species such as salmon. The marine oil tanker terminal will be located in the Douglas Channel near Kitimat, where tankers would load up to 2 million barrels of oil each and